infinite complacence, people went to and fro over the earth about their little affairs, serene in the assurance of their dominion over this small, spinning fragment of solar driftwood, which by chance or design, man has inherited out of the dark mystery of time and space.
Why don't you ask me what it feels like to be a freak?
The power of a new generation.
Greetings, you are listening to Savage Science Radio here at Jackalope 105 FM, and I am your host, Tracy Savage. What will it mean to be human in the future? Uploading consciousness into virtual worlds and prolonging life through biotechnology are already being contemplated, if not actually happening, right now. Canada's leading science fiction writer and one of my very favorite humans, Robert J. Sawyer, offers his insights in a lecture entitled Humanity 2.0, produced in collaboration with the Literary Review of Canada. I hope you enjoy this lecture, Humanity 2.0.
I am indeed a science fiction writer, and I'm also an optimist, and that is an unusual combination. Science fiction as a genre has a very distinct, easily traceable history. After much debate in the field, most of us who work in the field have come to agree with a British critic and writer named Brian Aldiss that science fiction was born with one particular literary work. That work was Mary Shelley's Frankenstein. Frankenstein has a subtitle. Most people don't know it. It's a good Trivial Pursuit question. The subtitle of Mary Shelley's Frankenstein is, or the modern Prometheus. Frankenstein or the modern Prometheus, the man who stole fire from the gods. The bicentennial of science fiction is shortly to be at hand. The year 1818 is when Frankenstein was first published. So in 2018, as we record these words, 7 years from now, will be the bicentennial of this genre. And most of the works that we think about when we think of science fiction are negative visions of the future. Why? I once asked Isaac Asimov, I had the great privilege of interviewing Isaac Asimov for another great public broadcaster, CBC Radio, in his penthouse apartment overlooking Central Park. One of the singular great moments of my life was get to visit him at his home. And I said, you're an optimist, but how do you make this work in writing in a field in which you have to write things that are going to be exciting? He said, you know, that's a really difficult thing to do, because the easiest thing to write about is strife and destruction and war and things going bad. And it's hard to make things going well dramatic. And so the field of science fiction, since its inception, since Mary Shelley, who wrote the first biotechnology novel, she wrote a novel about also new reproductive technologies, set out and gave us a template where which some scientific breakthrough, in the case of Frankenstein, of course it was Dr. Victor Frankenstein, figuring out how to reverse the biochemical process of putrefaction and decay that occurs post-mortally, after death, and bring dead matter back to life. It was very much about a scientific invention, scientific breakthrough, and how that would go wrong for people and why it would be an awful thing. And science fiction has given us this template over and over again. So I stand here to tell you that I'm a science fiction writer and an optimist with almost two centuries of my forebears telling you that they get the exact opposite, that the more you think about the future, the more terrified you should be. I am not terrified of tomorrow. In fact, I very much look forward not just to tomorrow, but a great deal of additional tomorrows. We are at the threshold of the end of human lifespan being what the Bible said human lifespan should be, which is 70 years. 70 years, we've bettered that a little bit in the 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 words since we started bringing these this concept of a 70-year lifespan, but we haven't bettered it in any substantial, significant way yet. We're going to live, I think, much longer lives than we are currently living, and in those much longer lives, we're going to see a much better world to live in than the one that we have been living in hitherto. And so one would ask, what possible basis is there for thinking that's going to be the case? We've done a pretty lousy job, most would say, for how old is humanity? Humanity is a species, Homo sapiens, in the fossil record, us, man, Homo, or people, as we more politically correctly translate the Latin today, people of, and sapiens means of wisdom. I think Carl Linnaeus, who gave us the name for our species, was either being very ironic or very optimistic in his own part by calling us Homo sapiens. But that is the name that we're saddled with as a species. We have not often lived up to that. And when we think about our relationship with science and technology and the future that's ahead of us, we very often live in fear of that future, with good reason for that fear. And I'm going to start now with a big science fictional but also scientific concept to explain to you, in fact, why even many of my colleagues share a real fear about the future. I was talking about anniversaries. Last year, 2010, was the 50th anniversary of a very interesting human endeavor. That endeavor is called SETI, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, an acronym, S-E-T-I, SETI. And SETI is the attempt to listen for radio broadcasts from elsewhere in our galaxy in hopes that we might pick up intelligible signals. And even, in the introduction, McLuhan was alluded to, Marshall McLuhan. The one true example of McLuhan's dictum that the medium is the message is SETI. There is nothing else for which that is really as true as SETI, and I'll explain why. The notion that merely receiving a message, even if you can't decode what it says, being a transformative thing, is directly relevant to the SETI notion. The concept that if we get a signal from the stars, even if we can't understand what it's saying, it is saying what? It is saying we are not alone, that there is somebody else out there who believes in the value of broadcasting, which is what we would be listening for. Radio broadcasts, television broadcasts, considered the pinnacle, I say to the camera, of human civilization is broadcasting, right? And the notion that you put things out there for others to pick up for free. And 50 years ago, in 1960, a man named Frank Drake really inaugurated what we call the modern SETI effort, starting to listen to the night sky, and actually, you can listen to the daytime sky, too. Radio telescopes work perfectly fine in the day. In fact, if you're going to want to, if any of the young people here, there are a few, want to grow up to be an astronomer, I'm telling you, become a radio astronomer rather than an optical astronomer. You get to work days if you're a radio astronomer. You got to work nights if you're an optical astronomer, okay? So make the right choice. Listening with radio telescopes for extraterrestrial signals, and Frank Drake thought with some reasonableness that all you had to do was turn these big radio dishes up towards the heavens and that you would find intelligent signals. We did not find intelligent signals. There are no intelligent signals after 50 years of listening. And although Frank Drake came up with a thing called the Drake Equation, which was trying to explain why that the universe is probably teeming with intelligent civilizations, the fact is we haven't found them, which led to Enrico Fermi, the great Italian physicist, to pose the Fermi paradox. The Fermi paradox is this. It's not a big, complex, quantum mechanical conundrum. It's a very simple, straightforward statement. If the universe should be teeming with life, where are all the aliens? It's a paradox. Everything we say in science and technology about the origin and evolution of life, when you step away from a theistic or a creationist point of view, says that there's nothing special about us. We're just organic chemistry, and organic chemistry should be common throughout the universe, and there should be life everywhere. But there does not seem to be. There does not seem to be. And so Fermi said quite rightly, well, where are they? Where are they? And the answer that a lot of my colleagues have come up with, a very good potential answer for the Fermi paradox, is germane to our topic tonight, which is that it is impossible for a technically advanced civilization to use Abraham Lincoln's famous words from the Gettysburg Address, to long endure. To long endure. As soon as, and in our own history, and there's no reason to think our history was special, radio was invented in 1895 by Marconi. 50 years later, a half century, less than a human lifetime later, nuclear weapons were invented. you have that number of decades, that short period of time on the cosmic scale from the point at which you become potentially detectable over astronomical distances, and you have the capability of destroying yourself through nuclear holocaust. And so one very good answer, which I'm going to try to gainsay tonight, one very good answer to Fermi's paradox, where are all the aliens, is they all came and they went. They weren't able to master. Steven Pinker happens to be in town today. You missed him, ha-ha, he came to see me, thank you. Steven Pinker happens to be in town today, and his current book also harks to Lincoln, The Better Angels of Our Nature, which I believe is from the second inaugural address, refers to his belief, of course, that we actually have great capacity for goodness within us. But the notion that we can't harness the bad parts of ourselves once they become available on a general basis means that the lifetime of a technological civilization is very, very short. Ours, if you take at the point at which we became a radio broadcaster, 1895, then we're about 116 years, if I'm doing my math right this late in the day, into being a technological civilization, and we've had the ability to destroy ourselves since 1945 or shortly thereafter with nuclear weapons, and then we decided that wasn't enough. We'll add biological weapons, and maybe we'll add making mini black holes at CERN, the European Center for Particle Physics, and a whole bunch of other ways, in case that having one way to destroy yourself wasn't enough, let's add a whole bunch of others, all of which are the fruits and gifts of technology. So the argument is that many of my colleagues would make is that civilization is not long for the world, is not a long-lived phenomenon, and that's why there are no aliens whose radio signals we can pick up. They may have come into existence, may constantly be bubbling into existence in the universe and then snuffing themselves out. Are we going to be any different? One possible answer, another possible answer, of course, is that we're the first. The universe is... How many of you watched The Big Bang Theory? You all know from the opening of The Big Bang Theory, about 14 billion years ago, the universe was in a hot, dense state, then boom, it all began in a Big Bang, right? We may be the first to emerge, so we may not have any other people to talk to because we were the first to show up on the scene. I don't think that's likely. In fact, what science takes as a standard position is that we're not special in any way, shape, or form. And being the first intelligent life in a universe that could routinely give rise to intelligent life seems going back to that kind of pre-Copernican notion that we're the center of the universe. So we may be the first. I don't think that's likely. It may be that everybody else snuffed themselves out. I don't think that's likely too, but I got to make the case for you because it's a perfectly good answer to the test we already did of trying to detect those other civilizations and failing to do so. And that brings us to the topic of this lecture, which went through some working titles as we were putting it together. Vodek, my friend over here, first suggested transhumanism for humanists, which I quite liked. The LRC ultimately decided on Humanity 2.0, and that also does a very good job for us and maybe avoided that jargon word transhumanism. But I want to talk a little bit about that word and why that word is relevant to not just science fiction writers like me. Transhumanism is common coin for us. It's arguable, and I would vociferously argue it, that we invented transhumanism. Transhumanism is the notion of going beyond the human condition. I said that Homo sapiens is 100,000 years old. That's true. Not only is it true, it's true to fine levels of detail. If I were to give you an anatomist, even if you were an anatomist, a perfectly preserved skull of a Homo sapien person from 100,000 years ago and one from today, you could not tell them apart, unless maybe one of them had porcelain fillings or ceramic veneers or something on their teeth. Except for that, you couldn't tell them apart. There's been no appreciable change in humanity for 100,000 years. So we have a human condition that has been very firmly and well established. And now I'm talking about it, but there's something beyond that. There's transhumanism, and transhumanism is the process of going beyond human to become post-human, which is something that follows humanity, after humanity. And the title we actually settled on, Humanity 2.0, implies, we all know what we mean by 2.0, we're talking about an upgrade, right? When a software release, the original one is 1.0, and then they get new features, a better version, and it's 2.0. A friend of mine got an iPad, and he was showing it off to me, and I said, oh, wow, you know, he wanted me to be impressed. And I said, well, is it an iPad 1 or an iPad 2? He goes, well, it's an iPad 1. And I said, boat anchor. Right? Because he's not got the latest and the greatest. We're all about upgrading our technology, but we haven't upgraded us in any significant way, shape, or form in 100,000 years. And the best that all of our science and technology has done to date is get us to go from where we would say the average lifespan, as they said to the people who wrote the Bible, 70 years, 70 years, to now we say it's a tragedy. I just actually, a friend of mine who was one of my high school teachers passed away at 68. Everybody, oh, so young, right? So young. That would have been a good ripe old age 30 or 40 years ago even, but not today. We've made a little bit of progress in life prolongation. I think we're going to make a lot of progress. So the first kind of transhumanism I want to talk about is the kind that actually, it turns out, is the most palatable to most people. The other kinds I'm going to talk about are fundamental dichotomies, fundamental disjunctures from what we recognize as being human. But simple life prolongation is something all of us want. As long as the quality of life is good and as long as we're mentally well-balanced, we want our lives to be as long and healthy as possible. Nobody wants life to be prolonged into a constant, endless decay. But if life can be prolonged in a healthy state, that's a wonderful thing. And we're looking forward to that possibility. I think it would be, of course, ridiculous to say that there aren't people alive now who will be alive in the 22nd century. Assuming we don't destroy ourselves, a child born today only has to live for 89 years to make it to the 22nd century. Nothing significant about that. I believe that there are people alive today who will live to the 23rd century easily, and possibly well beyond that. The game that people are playing in transhumanism right now is trying to live long enough to live forever, is the phrase that's used. Live long enough to live forever. Now, what does that mean? It means that each year we incrementally increase the average human lifespan in the developed world. It's a little bit longer every year. Right now, the length at which it's increasing actually depends on the authority you ask, but the typical figure that's bandied around is it's increasing 3 months for every calendar year that passes, okay? So that the average lifespan, if we say the average lifespan of males in North America right now is 85, then next year it's 85 and 3 months. And the year after it's 85 and 6 and 85 and 9, and then it's 86 years. And you get another season of life for every year later that you happen to be lucky enough to be born. That's the progress we're making. Well, of course, it didn't start out at 3 months. It started out at two months before that, 1 month before that, and a few weeks before that, and we went an awfully long period of time. Out of that 100,000 years, we went 99% of it with no progress whatsoever. The best fed pharaohs, kings, whatever you were, you weren't going to get more than 70 years if you were really lucky. Although, there were outliers. Sophocles, who wrote Oedipus the Rex, he lived to be 90 years old, which was a wonderful achievement for him, way better than any of his characters managed in his very bloody plays. It's 3 months right now. It's going to be 4 months soon, 5 months. And when we talk about living long enough to live forever, we talk about reaching that point where it's 6 months, 7 months, 8 months, 9 to 10, 11 months, and then the tipping point where the average human lifespan increases by 1 year for every year that passes. And then when it gets a little bit more than that, 13 months, for every year that passes, it doesn't matter that there's an end point because you're running ahead of the end point. You're running ahead of the expiration date that it seemed that was built into you. And it actually does, it probably is built into you. There's all kinds of reasons evolutionarily where it seems that, and again, it depends on which authority you ask, but 100 years, maybe 115, there are those who say 120 is the maximum amount of time that a human being can actually live under ideal circumstances with no threat of injury and with perfect nutrition and isolated from any devastating diseases and from war, that maybe 125 years would be the maximum before our bodies wear out. Among the things our bodies do, as I'm sure you know, is every time your DNA reproduces, there's little bits of junk DNA at either end of the the string. They're called telomeres because we can't just call them, well, we don't have a good name for those little junk things at the end of shoelaces, but we do have it for the end of DNA. They're called telomeres there. They get shortened every time the DNA reproduces, and they're junk. It doesn't matter that they got shortened because they're not used for anything, but once they get shortened and they're exhausted and DNA shortens because of the mechanics of how DNA reproduces, each reproduction cuts it a little bit from the end, you start reaching the point where you're cutting into the actual useful part of your DNA, and at that point the cell is, the DNA is no longer functionally able to reproduce. So there's a kind of a time limit built in. But you know what? We know how to extend those end caps again. We find that the causes, the laundry list, the reasons that we age are a well-established series of things, and there are not a whole lot of them now. One of the reasons we age is the shortening of our telomeres until our DNA can't reproduce properly. We have an enzyme called telomerase that lets us put our telomeres back in shape. Not a difficult problem, a tractable problem, a solvable problem. We age, of course, because of mechanical problems with our joints. I'm sure there are people in this room right here who have artificial joints already. You have artificial joints that are early 21st century or late 20th century technology. We're just getting better and better and better at that. We're learning, of course, all about stem cells, which we didn't know about all that long ago, and how to make adult stem cells grow into other things. So instead of buying a manufactured hip, eventually you will grow a new hip, or grow a new heart, or grow a new lung, a new eyeball, a new cornea, whatever you need. All of this sort of thing will be available to us. We're going to reach the point where we're going to live longer and longer and longer lives. Now that, I think, actually has a very positive effect on this negativity that I was talking about in terms of destroying ourselves. When you've got a few years left, even a few decades left, which is all any of us have, is a handful of decades, then you're willing to risk those handful of decades for what seems like a good idea at the time, like jumping out of an airplane for fun, or seems like an important cause, like going to war against your neighbor, or seems like it's what you should be doing. The longer that people have on the other side of what's left of their life, the more inclined to caution they're likely to be. If you're saying, well, if I go jump out of this airplane and I die, well, okay, I had a good 5 decades, and I only had 3 or 4 decades left anyways, I'm willing to take that risk. And so I'm going to jump out of an airplane at 51, and I've got 5,000 years on the other side. What I'm telling you guys is, in this volatile economy where there are lots of cheap stocks, the one not to buy is into a skydiving service, okay? As people start to live longer, they're going to move away from individually risky behaviors, but it also becomes less tolerable for there to be societally, culturally, nationally, planetarily risky behaviors, because so much is on the line. Now, we all say, well, we want to make a better world for our children. I talked about one of the genetic things that goes on, which contributes to our death, which is the shorting of telomeres. And so we want our children to have a better life. Well, we do want our children to have a better life. We also, to some degree, want to have our grandchildren to have a better life, and maybe even our great-grandchildren to have a better life. But the reality is that every generation you go into the future, you're cutting in half your genetic investment in whoever your descendants are. So that if I were to say to you in this audience here today that your second cousin, once removed, is going to have trouble paying his rent in 10 days when it's due, how many of you immediately reached for your wallet and said, well, I better give him some money? How many of you can even name your second cousin once removed? Your great-great-great-grandson is as closely genetically related to you as your second cousin once removed. Your emotional investment in the world of your great-great-great-grandson is exactly the same, genetics and Darwin and evolution have programmed us to believe, as your relationship to your second cousin once removed, which is not all that close. You feel bad that he's not going to make his rent, but you're not going to do anything about it. You feel bad that in 300 or 400 or 500 years, climate change may totally devastate the planet, but it's going to be not you or your children or anybody you really can conceptualize as being your family that's going to be impacted by that. And so we don't do anything about that. Why will the world be a better place when we have longer lifespans? Because we will have an enlightened self-interest in longer-term problem-solving. We have become genetically wired through the fact that nobody has ever lived, ever, ever lived for more than 130 years, ever. Nobody ever that we don't think in terms longer than that. In fact, we tend not to think even in century terms. We think at best in decades of planning. And we really these days are happy when somebody is thinking if they're a politician any longer than their term of office, which might be 2, 3, 4 years, 5 years. If it's a corporation these days, they're thinking in terms of quarterly results or annual results. Very few of them are thinking a decade down the road. No corporation is planning for a century down the road. Why? Because nobody who is currently invested in those things will still be around in that time. As we move into this era, which I think we will, including people who are alive now will be doing this, living long enough to live forever, where there's an indefinite human lifespan, a lifespan that may go on certainly for well over a century and conceivably indefinitely. When you say indefinitely, I mean 1,000 years. I mean in 10,000 years, 100,000 years, I mean practically forever, then it does become your problem. We don't have a really hard time telling people in their 20s that you really should open up a registered savings plan. We don't have a hard time telling them that you really should start planning for retirement. And we do that, and we make some social infrastructure that makes it easier for them to do so. You'll start wanting to think in much longer terms, or your children will, or at the very latest, it will be your grandchildren who will be the ones who will be facing this much longer perspective. And they will want the world to be a better place, not for an abstract notion of the future, but because that's where they're going to spend the rest of their lives, in the future. I think that kind of transhumanism is almost certainly at hand. We're very, very close to solving all of the remaining problems that are related to the longevity of our species. Now, people say, well, what do you do about the population explosion? My friend Marvin Minsky actually had the perfect answer. He said, you know what, got to re-injure human beings so they're only about 15 centimeters tall. If you could do that, he worked it out, the population the planet Earth could support would be about 100 trillion if we were 15 centimeters tall. We wouldn't have to worry about that problem for an awfully long time. Setting aside that possible answer, the only other answer, of course, is the same answer whenever there have been population pressures. Why are any of us here tonight? It's a bitterly cold evening by my standards here tonight, anyways, in Toronto, where we happen to be talking. Why are any of us here tonight? We as a species originated in wonderfully warm Africa. And what did we do? We moved out of Africa. In fact, everybody in North America, everybody in Canada is an immigrant. Every single person. Human life did not originate here. Even the natives walked here. Most of them walked here over the Bering Land Bridge connecting Siberia and Alaska during the last ice age. People walked here. Why would you do that? Why would you walk from Africa to Toronto? It's one heck of a walk to do that. You do it because of population pressures. You move out because there's too much competition where you are for the resources you require, and the grass always looks greener on the other side of the fence. There wasn't a lot of grass to be seen in some of the colder places they came to, but nonetheless, it was better than where they were, and so they moved out. We, of course, if we have radical life extension, will probably end up with a huge population explosion, because unless we come up with one of these science fictional scenarios that some of my colleagues would take great relish in writing, which is the draconian future where, yes, you can live to be 1,000, but we sterilize you today. You cannot have kids, because otherwise, you know, where are we going to put your kids and your kids' kids and kids' kids? The human race has always been about reproduction. We enjoy it, and we will continue to want to do it, which means we will move out into the solar system, of course. Mars is a small planet, just parenthetically, but it has this exact same dry land surface area as Earth does. So although it's much smaller than us, it doesn't have any oceans, it's all real estate. No beachfront property, it's all land, and it's perfectly right next door. We've got plenty of room to put people in the near term, and in the far term, I think we'll move out even farther. We will extend our lifespan, and it will give us perspective. It will give us a perspective that will make us feel positively about the future. Also, the extended lifespan will give us time. There are conundrums that we have never solved. One of the conundrums we've never solved is, how do you live with your neighbor? We fought forever as a species with our neighbors. There are all kinds of philosophical, sociological, societal, social justice conundrums that are as unsolvable, it seems, today as they were 100,000 years ago when the first Homo sapiens emerged. They're unsolvable because they're obviously very difficult problems. And the reality is nobody in the history of the human race has ever spent 100,000 years, which is an awfully long time, nobody has ever spent 100 years on any human problem. No one person has. There hasn't been anybody who's been an adult for 100 years working on a problem. Most of our problems are worked on at best for a few decades of a person's life. And then they take decades getting ready to tackle the problem. They go to school, grad school, what have you, finally find the right position. They spend a couple of decades and they're out. So is it any wonder that enormously big conundrums, puzzles, have gone unsolved? It's like any really complex project. If you abandon it and somebody else takes over, it's not that they pick up where you left off. They have to start at the beginning and get caught up with you just in time for them to retire. When we actually do have longer productive lifespans, I'm an optimist, and I do believe that these conundrums, these things that we've not been able to solve in terms of how do we get along with each other, how do we guarantee human rights and dignity for everybody on the planet, will be solvable by people who will spend 50 years, 75 years, 100, 200, if necessary, 500 years working on those problems. They will get solved because we will have the time to finally solve those problems. So it's one of the reasons I'm very optimistic about life prolongation as a very key part of the human experience for the better. More radical transhumanism involves an actual displacement from getting older to getting different, to becoming something other than Homo sapiens, to becoming a new species. And there are several different ways that that might conceivably happen. And I don't want to spend a huge amount of time on them, but I will say that the standard models were actually alluded to in the introduction. One is that we may decide that our biggest problem is the physicality of human existence. One way to solve dying is not to have a body. And we may find that we choose to dispense with the physical container that houses our consciousness. Now, this gets very philosophical. There are only two ways to look at human consciousness. One way to look at human consciousness is that it is divinely endowed, that you have a soul given to you by your creator, that it is fundamentally different from every other thing in the material universe, cannot be replicated, it only comes from God, it is the soul. I will not address that point here except to say that strikes me as the ultimate in terms of pre-Copernican thinking. There's something so special about me that it's outside the material realm of the universe. The other alternative is to say that our modern consciousness in Homo sapiens, the self-awareness that we have, is simply the end product of sufficient time and sufficient neural complexity, and that it emerged spontaneously and naturally and is part of the physical world that is subject to physical law, rational thought, and rational understanding. My friend Horst over here is my sound man, and I'm sure he's a brilliant, brilliant fellow. He can make for you an absolutely perfect copy of the most wonderfully beautiful recording of Beethoven's Fifth Symphony without understanding musical genius at all, without having the slightest insight into what Beethoven was thinking. It is eminently easy to take things that are more complex than your actual ability to understand and copy them. So we don't yet have a complete model of human consciousness. We may in fact never be able to model it completely because it sort of requires you to step back from yourself to do it, which becomes a very difficult thing to do. But the fact is that unless you believe in your heart of hearts that your consciousness is divinely endowed, it is within the realm of the physical universe. It can be digitized and copied just like anything else in the physical universe. And that means that at some point in the not too cosmically distant future, Horst or somebody else or TVO at a pledge break will say, send in your money and we will give you a recording of your consciousness on a DVD that you can take home and do something with. You will be able to take your consciousness and move it out of your body or copy it out of your body to somewhere else. If you don't like having a physical body, I actually do. I'm a little bit of a, this is only club soda, I say for the record. But I actually like the physicality of the human condition. And I like the changes that happen in my body most of the time as I get older and certainly grew taller and all that kind of stuff. But for those who find, perhaps they're a little older than me, that life is actually painful rather than pleasant most of the time, that your notion of getting up in the morning would be so much more pleasant if you didn't have to worry about the bad back, the bad hips, the failing eyesight, the failing hearing. One solution is to correct those biologically. Another solution is to say, you know what, that whole physical thing is so last millennium, and decide instead that you're going to become an uploaded consciousness, a transferred mind. Take your intellect and move it somewhere else. And you say, well, you're not really moving it. You're copying it and then maybe destroying the original. That's how all software has worked forever. I will ask you a philosophical conundrum. You go to bed every night. Your consciousness ceases. There's a discontinuity in your self-awareness. You do not remember the sum total of the 8 hours between when you go to bed and when you wake up. Your consciousness is shut down. The next morning, it is there again. Is it the same consciousness, or is it a different consciousness that simply remembers what the previous consciousness remembered? If it's the same consciousness, where did it go during that discontinuity? Consciousness is a stream of awareness. It ends. It is quite philosophically defensible to say that your consciousness dies every time you cease to be conscious. And a new consciousness that happens to access the same repository of memories comes into existence the next time you become conscious. If that, in fact, is what happens with us every single day of our lives, then there really is nothing that's any different about taking the consciousness that's in your head and moving it out into a virtual realm inside a computer or a physically robust android body. It is still a consciousness that ended and another consciousness that began, having access to the same memories. And it's, I think, very defensible philosophically that that's what actually happens to us all the time. I would, in fact, put it upon you to make the case that you have a continuity of consciousness. And that I'm going to simply say to you every night, count for those hours that you can't tell me what your consciousness was doing. Where did your consciousness go? Where did it go? It disappeared. It ended. And it was rebooted anew, a fresh consciousness, every new morning. That kind of humanity, transference, a consciousness transference, is also possible in the coming decades, for sure. And whether you decide that you don't want any physicality and you're going to live in a virtual realm, and you've all seen the wonderfully elaborate computer games that exist today, that we can make these computerized realities that are really compelling. They're not as detailed yet, but we all understand that it's only a question of time before they're as detailed as our real-world reality, and not nearly as frustrating as our real-world reality sometimes is, or whether you decide that you want to just have a perfect android body. Either way, that kind of transhumanism is going to be available. When that becomes the case, we come back to the Fermi paradox that I started this with. When you have the ability to shed the physical body and move on to another kind of existence, but still be human at the core of what you are, will you, in fact, want to listen to radio signals from other stars, or will you be more interested in other things? I don't know. But it may very well be that the universe is filled with civilizations who have decided that the least interesting thing to have a dialogue with is meat. That the least interesting thing to call up on the cosmic radio is protoplasmic life forms. That these things that haven't yet tasted of immortality, it would be literally like saying, you know what, I'm going to engage in a conversation with an infant, and I'm going to wait years for his or her reply, because the speed of light dictates that the reply won't be instantaneous. So I'm going to say to the infant, how are you today, and wait decades or centuries for goo goo gaga to come back. It's a non-starter. It's a non-starter, I think. So the fact that we haven't had any communication with sibling intellects simply implies, yes, as I said at the beginning, that the lifespan of a civilization of this type, of century plus or minus a few decade lifespans, in physically instantiated carbon chemistry shells, is very short. But it doesn't mean that the lifespan of any civilization, of a civilization that is transhumanistic to the state of being post-humanistic, has gone beyond humanity to become something new, is in any way necessarily abbreviated on the cosmic stage. The argument being that we will desire a longer-term stability when we ourselves become stable on a much longer basis. And I think that's a defensible position. Now, that said, I don't say that we should prepare in a Pollyannish way for the future. We shouldn't say that everything is going to be sweetness and light automatically. It behooves us to be vigilant about anything that is a threat to our long-term existence. And the single biggest threat to our long-term existence has always been us, the disgruntled part of us in the current situation. Terrorism is the single biggest threat we face on a long-term basis. That is, climate change, yes, that will happen over a period, is happening, absolutely is happening, over a period of decades and centuries. But if somebody gets large-scale nuclear weapons or biological weapons, quite conceivably in the next century or decade or century, we all run the risk of extinction. And that's a very scary place to be. And so I'm going to close my formal part of this presentation with my, again, I always talk, my parents are economists, so I always talk, I guess, in terms of what's in it for the people who are participating in this, my call for an enlightened self-interest, which says make the world a better place. There are people in this world who do not have as much as we have, who are sitting here in the warmth and the bright light and enjoying, hopefully a pleasant evening out at a lecture, don't have enough to eat, don't have clean water, don't have all of the things that we take for granted. H.G. Wells, I talked about Mary Shelley being the father, the progenitor of science fiction. She's the grandmother. H.G. Wells is the father of science fiction. And in 1902, he wrote War of the Worlds. And War of the Worlds, you can read today, a new reading. This is what literary people do, is they bring a new reading to an old text. A new reading of War of the Worlds is it's the novel about terrorism. And what is it that Wells talks about in the opening of War of the Worlds? He talks about the Martians, who have, in his conceptualization, their world was older than our world. That's the way people conceived of the solar system kind of becoming habitable from the outside in as it cooled. And Wells' time, that was perfectly good science. So Mars was an older civilization that had exhausted its resources. And he has this wonderful line in the opening paragraphs of War of the Worlds about intellects vast, cool, and unsympathetic that slowly but surely drew their plans against us. They looked at the haves, they were the have-nots, and said, that's not fair, we'll take what they have. As long as we have a world in which there are haves and there are have-nots, all of this sunny future that I've been talking about, a future where people live for centuries, if not millennia, a future where we solve social justice problems and all the other great conundrums of human existence because there's been sufficient time to bring to bear on those problems at last and solve them, all of that is at risk so long as there are others on this planet who slowly and surely, and they think self-righteously, draw their plans against us. The best thing we can do to make a sunny tomorrow is make sure that everybody today lives in dignity, liberty, safety, and compassion. And that's my message to make the world a better place. Thank you.
I was really intrigued by the concept of consciousness continuing in a virtual world.
Yes.
And I mean, I know at home I have my dad's old record player. It's 38 years old. And I have an iPod at home. The battery of it lasts, I think, about 2-3 years.
Yes.
So we have the more modern technology, but a lot of it often doesn't last as long. And I was just wondering, would the consciousness of the virtual world, would the consciousness then end if we had a point, say, where the DVD got scratched or something
right
like that?
A DVD is a static recording. A 3.5-inch disc, a VHS tape, all of those are static recordings. They're not animated. Consciousness is not a snapshot. It's a series of frames. It's an animated process. It moves along. So it executes. Consciousness runs. It's not data. It is actually a program. It's a running, ongoing thing. And yes, you want to have wherever it is stored to be a robust medium. But it is not like we're going to suddenly not be able to read your DVD of you, because that DVD, when it was recorded, let's say I record your consciousness today, 5 years from now, that DVD is useless to both you and me. We don't want a snapshot of what you were like 5 years ago. Do you want to, unless in case of traumatic memory or something like that you want to get rid of, we don't want to dispense with the experiences we have. It's our experiences that define us. So the answer is no. There's really no danger of that. There used to be people worried all about time about the loss of a stratum of our culture, our human culture. I was just across the street at the Royal Ontario Museum today with my friend Virginia. We were looking at the Egyptian artifacts there. And of course, experts, I can't, but experts can read the hieroglyphics from thousands of years ago, no problem at all. But we say, well, we're going to lose everything that was on 5 1/4 inch floppies or 3 1/2 inch floppies. Well, I copied all of my 3 1/2 inch floppies onto my hard drive a long time ago. And when I get a new computer, I dump everything from my first computer that had a hard drive, had a 10 megabyte hard drive. Now it's easy to get a 2 terabyte hard drive. You just keep dumping everything into successively larger buckets. And as long as you get a new bucket that's before the old one wears out, you have infinite existence of that data. I will not lose any of my data. 100 years from now, 1 million years from now, the data will be dumped into buckets. In fact, my archives will be at McMaster University. Students 1,000 years from now will be able to read my WordStar for DOS files when they want to do their master's thesis on this obscure 20th century guy who got it all wrong about what the future was going to be. Thank you.
On the subject of life prolongation, you addressed this in the final seconds of your talk about the haves and the have-nots and the world. If there is no revolution, if there's no terrorism, the world continues on, but we do have life prolongation, there will still be haves, still be have-nots. Do you envision a world where a lot of people will live to 200, 250 years old and others will die at 100? And where do you see that going?
The most interesting part in anything like this is the transitional stage, because, of course, life prolongation will come to market and be obscenely expensive, right? And then it will get cheaper and cheaper and cheaper. So there will be a period where there definitely will be people who will have a lot more longevity than other people. And that will be a point that we will have a hard time getting through. We have to be very careful about how this is done, because we're already furious that the rich have found a way to avoid taxes. But the great leveler was that they couldn't avoid death, Steve Jobs being the example that's most recently to mind here. He was one of the richest men in the world, and he isn't with us anymore, and nothing could be done about that. And, you know, not to make light of his death or anything, but there's a leveler. Nobody got longevity. And when we have this transitional period, we're going to have to be very, very careful about that. And again, I talk about recognizing that those who have less than you and have reason to resent you is in fact the worst thing that for you. The circumstance we have right now where everybody at the high end, where the 1%, you know, we're all talking about occupy this city and that city, where the 1% wants more and more of everything and the 99% has less and less, is the worst thing, obviously, for the 99%. It's also the worst thing for the 1%, because it's what leads to the 1%, the 99% rising up and finally getting rid of the 1%. French Revolution, all over again, right? So what we will need at that transitional stage is we're going to have something like a national lottery where everybody's got a chance to live forever, regardless of who they are. You don't even have to buy the lottery ticket. If you've got a Canadian social insurance number, you're entitled to be in the national lottery to live forever. We're going to have foundations like the Canada Council for the Arts, but they will be the ones that say, you know what, here's a great artist, here's a great thinker, here's a great ethicist, and that one should be around too, even though, you know, traditionally our great artists, thinkers, or ethicists, the only people who make less money than writers are philosophers and ethicists, after all, should be around as well. There will be a need for it to be seen as egalitarian, or else it will be one of the huge crisis points in human history.
At the beginning of your talk, you discussed the search for intelligent life.
Yes.
And towards the end of your talk, you put forward the idea that perhaps we can't see that intelligent life because they have evolved through transhuman-like processes into consciousnesses that are virtually impossible for our species to detect, and and consciousnesses that have no interest in talking to us. So given that, I was wondering what your thoughts are on our current efforts to search the universe for intelligent life and
sure.
how it may need to evolve.
I'm a big proponent of SETI, and perhaps that didn't come through in the talk here. In fact, last year, on the 50th anniversary of the SETI effort, the SETI Institute in Mountain View, California, had the first ever SETI conference, general public, and I was the only science fiction writer invited to participate in that conference. I'm well known in the SETI community through novels like Rollback and Factoring Humanity for being a huge proponent of the SETI effort.
Good product placement.
Why am I such a big proponent? Because the cost is minuscule. The cost is so low for SETI. It's an embarrassment that the United States alone, I might add, amongst big superpowers, has not one public dollar spent on SETI anymore. The entire effort. I call SETI the Blanche DuBois of scientific endeavors. It has always depended on the kindness of strangers, at least in the United States. It has to go begging for money. But the cost of operating the SETI effort, which is mostly passive listening with radio telescopes, is minuscule. It's tiny, and the potential rewards are huge. I said that the medium is the message, the knowledge that we are not alone. It actually would be very gratifying to know that civilizations do make this transition that I've been talking about, from being in fear of their own mortality to being essentially immortal players on the galactic stage. Instead of it just being a science fiction writer arguing it on public television, it would be a message from space saying, hey, guess what? You know, we've been around a long time, and this can actually work, and if you guys don't screw up, maybe you'll follow in these footsteps. So my enthusiasm for most scientific research, especially scientific research that's inexpensive, is boundless. When we talk about, and for me, it's obscene, the amount of money that's spent on this planet in armed military conflict. One of my personal things I can't believe is the world would be such a better place if the brightest people on the planet would stop making the things the stupidest people on the planet wanted them to make. We'd be in way better shape. And I think in the case of SETI, it's so cheap, we should be listening, because why wouldn't we listen? Why wouldn't you listen? On the off chance when it costs so infinitesimally small amount of money.
But is there something you would like to see else done as well?
The business of government should be doing those things that are not profit-centric, right? Should be doing those things that are for the good of the species, where nobody's making a buck. Capitalism works really well for things that are private enterprise. There's no direct monetizing of SETI, right? If the alien signal comes in, they'll be able to pick it up in Beijing, they'll be able to pick it up in Moscow, they'll be able to pick it up with home receivers, everybody will be able to listen, everybody will be able to do whatever they want with it. So it's not something that there's a profit motive in being involved with. It's the ideal kind of thing for our tax dollars to work on, is things that will ultimately, hopefully, benefit us all. And if they don't benefit us all, they don't at least hurt anything. And I'm also a huge believer, just parenthetically here, that we need a space program, we need things like SETI, we need fundamental physics research. One of the great things that Canada has of the last few years is the world's leading theoretical physics think tank in Waterloo, the Perimeter Institute for Theoretical Physics, because we need something for the best and brightest of our young people to do with their lives other than the war effort, other than going into making weapons of mass destruction. And we need positive pursuits that require really big brains. And the more of those we have, the better off we are as a species.
I'm curious about your thoughts on the psychological effects of living forever. I mean, I can predict your answer is positive, but why do you think that a human being would be able to psychologically live for 1,000 years or 1,000,000 years?
How old are you?
I'm 22.
You're 22. I mentioned that I interviewed Isaac Asimov at his apartment in New York City. I also interviewed probably the greatest female science fiction editor who ever lived, Judith Merrill, who spent her latter years here in Toronto at the same time. I was even older than you in that I was 24. And I said to Judith Merrill, who was, I guess, in her 70s at that point and went on to be a great friend of mine, that I didn't understand why you would want to live forever. Wouldn't it be boring, and what would you do with all that time? And she looked at me and she said, only somebody who was young could question the desire for more. As you get near the end, you're not conscious of how much you've accomplished. You're conscious of how much you haven't yet accomplished. It seems that we have a boundless ability to absorb information. And what happens when we absorb information or read a book is we don't remember the book. If I ask you what books you read in the last year, you might be able to name the titles. That's almost a trivia question. Then each book average 100,000 words. So I'll make it easy on you. Give me a 10,000 word précis of any book you read. You can't. You're lucky if you remember a couple of characters' names if it's a novel, or two or three high points if it's a nonfiction book. But the process of intaking that information has fundamentally altered the neural networks of your brain. Your brain is a malleable, changing organism, and it changes throughout your life. We all know the classic example of people starting out as liberal and ending up as conservative, and looking back at what they believed when they were 20, when they're in their 50s or 70s, and they can't believe that that's what they believed or what they fought over or what they cared about. We are changing entities. It doesn't seem that our brains calcify as time goes on. It doesn't seem that they are in a step-by-step process that can only go so many transitions. It seems that the longer we live and the more input and resources we have access to, the more we change over time. And the fact that we had no trouble whatsoever, and I talked about 70 years, but of course we all know this figure that a Neanderthal or an early Cro-Magnon who lived to be 30 was an old person. That was because of a high degree of risk in life, right? You were dying because somebody bit your head off or something. We've had no trouble transitioning as a species that routinely died at young ages. We structured our whole lives based on what now seem like incredibly obsolete notions, that your life would be apportioned into primary learning, secondary learning, post-secondary learning, learning enough in those 3, 4, or 10 years post-secondarily to make a living for 20 to 30 years and then retire. The human animal doesn't work that way in the developed world anymore. There's no way if your field is computer science or oncology or broadcasting, my own degree in radio and television arts from Ryerson, and I look at equipment here that I will not be able to operate, whatever you're doing, you have to keep up with it. Lifelong learning from an old compartmentalized line, we did that just fine. Living and doing 2, 3, 4 careers in a lifetime, it turned out the human being could adapt to that without any difficulty whatsoever. The notion, in fact, I don't want to go way over time here, but one of the things that I argue, I have a trilogy about Neanderthals, and one of the things that's commonly argued about why Neanderthals died out and we survived is we invented grandparents. We invented the notion of living just long enough to have two generations of wisdom instead of only one extant to protect the young people. And we adapted to that. We adapted to the notion of being a grandparent, which was something almost nobody lived to see 100 years ago or 200 years ago, to being a great-grandparent, which a great number of people lived to see, to living over a century. I remember 1967, Canada's centennial year. They got people who were 100 years old and sent them out for show and tell to schools. Anybody remember that? We had a centenarian come to our school, and I felt really bad for the old guy because he was like being taken around because nobody had ever seen somebody who had lived as long as our country had been alive. And now people routinely live to be 100 years old. You'll see, go look at Facebook, and you'll see all kinds of people who are celebrating or just came back from their parents or grandparents' 100th birthday or 102nd birthday. The malleability of the human intellect, the human spirit, to huge changes has been amply demonstrated. And I think, with all due respect to your question, I think it's a disservice to humanity and a dismissal of the greatness of what we've accomplished to date to say that that ability to accommodate ongoing change is near its end of its resilience. Thank you all very much. Thank you.
Support Ontario's public television. Donate at tvo.org.
There you can see why he's one of my favorite humans. The optimist will win. We will. Well, this brings us to a close of another episode of Savage Science Radio. I'd like to thank Nick Palucco and his beautiful show graphics, Dennis Pond and Hawk Productions for that really cool intro that we use every week, and none other than Todd Sheets, our executive producer and owner of Jackalope 105 FM. And until next week, keep your powder and your pants dry, and happy trails to you.
Every morning, I grab my donut and coffee and I sit down at my screen. Nothing gets me going like the possibility of knowing there might be an intelligent extraterrestrial message for me. Every day is the same, we don't hear anything, but we like to play Sudoku. Lately we've been into live action role playing games. We know it's only a matter of time before we finally find intelligent life. Say it hi.
Hi.
Hello.
Hello.
What is your planet like?
Well, all right.
Have you cured all disease?
No.
Have you achieved world peace?
No.
Is your skin pale green?
No.
Do your spacecraft come with tractor beams?
No.
Do you wear shiny clothes?
Rarely.
What about long flowing robes?
Well, actually, right now I'm in my boxers.
Oh. Well, how many intergalactic languages do you know?
Well, I did take French in high school.
French? Hold on.
Okay.
Can you specify your exact location?
In Canada.
Canada.
Canada. Broadcasting from my little shortwave radio. In Canada.
Canada.
Canada. Broadcasting from my little shortwave radio.
Know how to speak English anyway.